Welcome back to Issues Etc. Boy, time flies. My goodness. Here we are in the third hour already. We've come to our conversation about Christian education in the inner city. Right across the river from where I'm sitting is East St. Louis. We're going to be talking with the principal of Unity Lutheran School in East St. Louis. Talk about the unique challenges that face a Christian educator and a Christian school in the inner city. And I said it before, as a parish pastor, I served just south of East St. Louis, far enough south that we were actually in the country. And many of my parishioners, the older ones, grew up in East St. Louis. They watched that city in decline, and many of them were very sad about it. We're going to be talking about the inner city situation and those challenges here in the first 25 minutes of this last hour of Issues Etc. Adolf Horstadt will join us. He's author of our Issues Etc. book of the month for February, the Concordia Commentary on Joshua, in about 25 minutes. One of the biggest problems in the book of Joshua that faces the reader, even the casual reader, is what he has termed divine warfare. God commands his people to go to war. He tells them that he is, in fact, fighting war for them. And it's a pretty bloody story, if you pay attention. We'll talk about divine warfare in about 25 minutes on Issues Etc. with Adolf Horstadt. Our call-in numbers, if you'd like to join this conversation, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Paul Miller is our guest. He's principal of Unity Lutheran School in East St. Louis. Paul, thanks for coming over and joining us here in Studio A.
Well, you're welcome, Todd.
Tell us about your experience, first of all, in the inner city, especially as a Christian educator.
Well, actually, I'm a country kid. I grew up in the country in Michigan, and that's where I had my experience as a child and a high schooler, and I actually went to a very small college called Olivet College, which was a school of 800 in a town of 200 out in the boonies, so to speak, in Michigan. And my whole growing up time was from the country. But then in 1976, I went to a Lutheran school on the south side of Chicago, and I'm talking about right in the center of the south side of Chicago. And I'd never lived in a city, never been to Chicago. I grew up in the country, so this was quite a cultural change for me. And when I started there, the neighborhood was all white, and we stayed there for 19 years. I met my wife. She was a member of the church where I was serving. We had four children. We bought a house across the street. In the 80s, the neighborhood changed mainly to Hispanic. And then in the 90s, the neighborhood changed again, and it was largely African American. And we just stayed right there, and we watched this whole thing happen, and it was really an education for me, seeing the people come and go and staying right there at that Lutheran school. And the neighborhood got pretty intense when we would go out on our back porch. Was common to see drug deals going down on the corner, and kids having their bikes stolen right out from under them, and people's houses broken into. So it got pretty intense. But through it all, we could see the value and the power of a Lutheran school in a setting like that, because we had a lot of families from the neighborhood that came and enrolled their kids in our school, and they just really appreciated the Christian education, the type of environment that we were providing in the Lutheran school. And we recognized that there was a lot of good things that could happen through a Lutheran school.
Now, you served for the last several years here at Unity School in East St. Louis.
Well, actually, Unity, we're only in our second year right mm-hmm. now. So in 1995, it was time for us to get out of the city. My kids, my oldest son was 15 years old, and I have three younger than that, and the neighborhood just wasn't right for raising a family anymore. My in-laws had moved out of Chicago to a little town in southern Illinois called Prairie Town. Are you familiar with Prairie Town?
I know exactly where it's at. Not far from where I live, in fact.
Yeah, so we would come down and visit them all the time and go right through Staunton. And as the Lord would have it, they needed a principal at Zion Lutheran School in Staunton, so we accepted the call there and stayed there for 7 years. And while I was serving there, the Southern Illinois District was looking for people to serve on a task force to consider the possibility of opening a mission school in East St. Louis. And when we left Chicago, my wife and I both said, it's time to leave now, but maybe someday the Lord will allow us to get back into that type of a ministry again, because we just really appreciated it, but the time wasn't right. So when they were looking for people to be on this task force, I raised my hand and said, I'd like to do that. So we had a group of about close to a dozen people. We took advantage of the Synod's Genesis project, did a feasibility study in the area, talked a lot about different issues, and then finally came time to say, yeah, we're going to go with this, and we need to call our first principal, and they ended up calling me. I worked for a year by myself just in development, and then last year was the first year of classes, and this is our second year now. So
now, tell us about having experienced kind of the transition of a neighborhood in South Chicago, which is inner city. I mean, we're talking about inner city there in the most genuine sense. Compare that with the situation that prevails in East St. Louis.
Well, there's some similarities. There's a lot of differences as well. When you go into an inner city environment like the South Side of Chicago, the homes are so much closer together, and there's lots of large apartment buildings where people are living who don't own them. There's a lot more traffic, foot traffic and car traffic as well. And to me, it's just so much more close. It's so much more intense than East St. Louis. East St. Louis, on the other hand, the yards and the homes are bigger. They're a little more spread out. But in East St. Louis, I really feel like the poverty level is much worse there than it was on the south side of Chicago. That's my experience, that people, that's the number one problem, despite what you might hear on the television or the radio or read in the newspaper about all the different things in East St. Louis that go on. The biggest problem is people just point blank don't have much money, and then that leads to all sorts of other problems in the community.
What are those problems, if you could just tick them off quickly, that prevail in the inner city and in East St. Louis in particular, that contribute and that come out of the situation of poverty, but also contribute to the challenges that are unique to doing Christian education in the inner city?
Well, there's cultural differences, obviously. Those are a big factor, although one of the easiest to overcome. I find that the differences in cultures and races are easy to overcome if you're the kind of person who is interested in other people and willing to reach out and spend time. I think we've done a lot to overcome any differences between the cultures. Another problem is that the people, like in East St. Louis, there is one other parochial school. It's a Catholic school located pretty far away from where we're at. And other than that, this is having a parochial school is a foreign concept to most of the people there. So they're just not sure what we're doing or that we're even there. So trying to get them to think a different way about a parochial school compared to the public school education that they had growing up, that's another challenge, just to get them to buy into what we're doing. They're really convinced, the parents really enjoy our school, but to getting them to take ownership, that's something that's going to be a little more of a long-term goal there. So the funding is obviously a challenge. We're located at Unity Lutheran Church, which is the only Lutheran church in East St. Louis, but we're actually operated by the district. And so we knew the people that were going to put their kids in our school weren't going to have much money. That was a foregone conclusion that the people would not have much money.
And Lutheran education, by the way, is expensive. There's no two ways to cut that one.
Right.
It's expensive.
Yeah, it's expensive. So the problem for a lot of other Lutheran schools that become inner city, urban Lutheran schools is that they're still operating under an old paradigm of Lutheran education, how it's funded, which is a lot of times a drawback for those Lutheran schools. It causes them long-term financial difficulties. We had the advantage of opening this school saying, how is this thing going to be funded? How are we going to fund the school and come up with actually a business plan before the school was opened? And that's going along fairly well, realizing that we're not going to depend on one congregation or the completely on the parents. It's just not going to happen that way. So that's a challenge that we've had time to address as well, and that's actually going pretty well. So
one of the challenges, if I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to be either a pastor or an administrator in a school in the inner city, one of the biggest challenges I think I might face, and tell me if this is true, is I can be almost invisible to people outside that situation. Mm-hmm. People outside the inner city are simply not going to know that I'm there, that the school's there, and in that sense, not be able to lend their help. Is that a challenge too?
Well, that is a challenge, and it always kind of surprises me. You know, for as much, you know, we just got done celebrating Martin Luther King Jr. birthday, and for as much has been talked about and done in the last 40 years or so to improve people's economic status and in our country, things haven't really changed a whole lot. I live in a small town called Staunton, which is about 5,000, and I commute to East St. Louis. And I just love living in that little town. You know, it's so safe and secure, and everybody pretty much thinks the same way, and it's really neat. East St. Louis is completely different. It's a completely different environment to live with. And a lot of the ways the people are the same. They have the same needs, but just the way they go about accomplishing how they are going to have those needs met is much different. And I find that the people who live in East St. Louis just have no idea what it's like to live in a small town like Staunton. And the people in Staunton largely have no idea what it's like to live in East St. Louis. And that's true for a lot of small towns. One of our goals is to make a connection there, to connect people from Lutheran congregations all over the district and even beyond with East St. Louis. And so it's really common for us to have people come down and visit. It's like Jeff, that's how I met Jeff. He came down with his child in their school from Warden to visit our kids. So we try to make that connection. Mm-hmm. If we can get them to come and visit or get our kids to go visit their congregation, we really make some nice connections to get people to meet each other. So that's actually part of our plan.
Now, you had mentioned before some of the challenges that are facing there. Talk about those challenges in terms of family. What's the family situation for the average prospective student in the inner city for Christian education?
Well, I'm always interested in different data. And we have 35 students right now. And the first one that's the first fact about those students that's actually most important to me is that only 3 of them are baptized. So we have 32 unbaptized students. And a lot of them go to other Christian churches where they don't baptize their infants. But I would say about 2/3 of them come from families that are basically unchurched. So that's our main goal, is to teach the Christian faith to those children and then possibly get to their families as well.
So a mission to the family through the children.
Yes.
Now, that's a goal that I think probably every... I send my kids to parochial school. Mm-hmm. I know that's a major goal of and this is out in the most affluent... Mm-hmm. The most affluent section of St. Louis, of all of St. Louis, and it's the same goal, reaching the parents and the family through the children.
Right. We are hoping to be, trying to be as intentional about that as possible. Mm-hmm. Now, another interesting fact, out of our 35 students, 29 of them come from low-income homes, based on their free and reduced lunch applications.
What does that mean, then, low income? Because a lot of people say, well, I'm low income, but what does that really mean?
What that means in a lot of cases, a lot of them, they're just unemployed. They're not working. But there's also a significant number of what we call working poor. So we have a lot of single moms who are working full-time jobs. They submit a copy of their check stub to me for financial aid application, and I figure that all out. They're working full-time, but they're still in the low-income bracket because of the jobs that they have. So we have several working poor families as well. So I have been in a couple of the homes. Interestingly enough, at Christmas time, there was one family that I was able to connect with, a congregation actually out in Staunton, and they bought some Christmas gifts for the family, and I delivered them to the home, and they live in a public housing complex. I was able to go into the apartment, and it's actually pretty nice. I mean, the kitchen was refurbished. The cabinets looked pretty nice. It was clean, but there was very little in there. She had no kitchen table or chair. She had a couch in the living room, and in the bedrooms there was a bed and a TV, and that was about it. So their basic needs are met. But as far as luxury items or beyond that, things like a parochial school education, there wouldn't be a lot of money available for that. So,
you had mentioned funding, and the way people think usually about parochial school in terms of funding is, well, either a congregation is going to pay the full freight, and this is the old model, very old model now, and kids will go free, or we'll charge tuition. Now, neither of these seem feasible in the inner city in most situations.
Yeah.
How do you think outside the box, then, with regard to funding?
Well, outside the box is a good way to put it. First of all, the tuition issue. We thought long and hard, and we prayed about that tuition. What are we going to do about tuition, realizing that the families coming to us aren't going to have much money? And what we finally came up with is we set our tuition real high. Our tuition is $3,400 a year. I don't know what it is at your school. But
that's higher, actually.
Actually higher. Yeah. It's one of the highest ones. But our thinking there is that when a family comes in, everybody fills out a financial aid application, and I have the freedom to talk with the family about, based on their application, what are they able to afford for tuition. So every family is different, so it's a sliding scale tuition. And it's so high that nobody's going to be able to pay the whole amount. So everybody actually gets financial aid also. So everybody pays tuition, nobody goes for free. Everybody gets financial aid, and it's just based on their income. And for a lot of them, it's a sacrifice. They're making a sacrifice to do that.
But that seems to go to the whole issue of ownership as well.
Mm-hmm.
Ownership for this is, even if I'm only paying $15 a month or something like that,
mm-hmm.
it is still ownership of the Christian education for my child.
Right. When I interview parents, one of the things I try to get across to them is that we want them to be involved with their child's education. Now, at the public school, I don't sense that there's many parents involved with what goes on at school, but we tell them right up front, we want you involved with this your child's education, because the kids whose parents are involved are the better students. So your first step in being involved is you're going to pay some tuition. The second step is we want you to check homework, make sure they're here on time, come for parent-teacher conferences, and be involved and maybe in some fundraising or something like that, but we do want them involved for the sake of their child. And then also for the mission aspect of it, too. The more we get to know them, maybe we'll have a better chance of inviting them to church or whatever.
Paul Miller is our guest. He's principal of Unity Lutheran School in East St. Louis. We're talking about Christian education in the inner city. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues, Etc. In about 10 minutes at 5:30, we'll be talking with Dr. Adolf Harstadt. He is author of our Issues, Etc. book of the month for February, the Concordia Commentary on Joshua. This is the second in the four-part series we're doing with him during the month. We're going to talk about the problem of divine warfare in the book of Joshua. That's coming up in about 10 minutes here on Issues, Etc. If you'd like to join us with a question or a comment on inner-city Christian education, our call-in numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Talk about the level of education that prevails in the inner city, even in the public school system, and how that represents another challenge to Christian education there.
Well, according to statistics, in the East St. Louis public schools, only half of the students who start school finish high school. So there's about a 50% attrition rate there. Dropout rate is the at what point they would drop out, I don't know, but only about 50% finish school. So, of course, we are trying to emphasize the value of education and finishing elementary school and going on through high school. Our kids are only real little right now, but of course, we want them to continue on with their education after they leave Unity whenever that time comes. So, but like you say, the prevailing attitude isn't always real positive towards, you know, finishing school in that community.
What, from your observation in the inner city, what happens to those kids, the 45% that don't graduate from high school, don't finish high school? Mm-hmm. What happens to them?
You know, I don't really know. Only by my observation, I know when you drive down the street from our school, there's a grocery store a couple blocks down, and across the street is an abandoned, I don't know what it was. It was a parking lot of some sort. There's a lot of guys hanging out there all day long. You go by early in the morning, there's guys just sitting out there. And I think my perception is that's what happens to a lot of them. They just end up sitting around and playing the system. They just play the system to have their needs met, whether that's Social Security or welfare or whatever the case may be. You know, they just play the system. In fact, I drove through there with one of the dads helping me one day, and he said, these guys have doing nothing down to a science. They got doing nothing down to a side. So I think that's where a lot of it ends up. I know that's not every one of them, but that's a lot of them playing the system.
Let's talk before our time runs out about the future of Unity School there, the future plan. Someone drives through and they see that. I've seen it myself. I have been down to East St. Louis many times. And you say, why even try? You obviously are are thinking completely differently. What's the future of Unity School there in East St. Louis?
Well, we're really excited about the future. Our enrollment last year was 17 students with two classes. This year we went up to 35 with three classes, so that was a good increase. Next year we're going to add another pre-kindergarten class because we had to turn so many families away in pre-kindergarten. We're also going to add second grade. And right now we're looking at our need for additional classroom space because after next year all of our existing classrooms will be full.
You're meeting in the basement of Unity Lutheran Church.
Yes, right, we renovated that and we have room for five classrooms down there and those will be filled after next year.
Good.
So we're right now looking at different options of how we're going to get more classroom space. So that won't happen for a couple of years yet, but we need to be thinking about it right now. I think as word spreads about our school around the community, and as we continue to get the support of congregations and individuals all over the place, I think we'll grow and be a positive influence in that community and in the church for a long time. I'm just convinced of it.
And how can our listeners help? I know many have been listening to this point and say, what can I do to help?
The biggest thing, believe it or not, and I don't mean to, this people say this all the time, but to pray for Unity Lutheran School. It's one of the things that's really been a blessing to me as I've been involved in this project. I've been a Lutheran Christian all my life, but my faith has taken a big quantum leap in the last couple of years as I've seen people, I know people are praying for us all the time, and to see the answers to those prayers, believe me, it's not just something that people do because somebody asked them to. God is really answering their prayers, and we are privileged to see those. I wanted to mention my three teachers.
Yes.
Because they are answers to prayer right there. Ms. Tisdale is our pre-kindergarten teacher. Ms. Harm is our kindergarten teacher. Mrs. Christy Price is our first grade teacher. They're wonderful. They are answers to prayer. God sent them to join in this mission, and their reason for being at Unity is our reason for being there, and they just do a fantastic job. Our kids love coming to school. They just love coming into the building. They love going into the classrooms because they know they're going to be well taken care of, and they know something interesting is going to happen throughout the day. Mm-hmm. So I give my hats off to my teachers. They're great.
And to the person who says, you know, I look at this situation and everyone else, all the social systems seem to have kind of abandoned the inner city. With only a minute, make your case for the church not abandoning the inner city, and especially those kids.
Yeah. There is great potential. As I look at those kids, every one of them has a future. And just on a personal note, a few weeks ago, my dad died in Michigan. And when I went to his funeral, I had the thought that he was 76 years old. And at the funeral, I thought, this is the culmination of 76 years of ministry, word and sacrament ministry. He was baptized as a baby, belonged to a Lutheran church his whole life. It was a culmination of 76 years of ministry. And I couldn't stop thinking about those kids who are just starting their walk with Jesus. Can we put them in a position where they are lifelong Christians, lifelong Lutherans? Why not? You know, why not lifelong Lutherans with a whole life of word and sacrament ministry to them? Why not? It could happen.
God bless you on your efforts. Please keep up the good work.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Paul Miller is principal of Unity Lutheran School in East St. Louis. You know, yesterday we were talking with Pastor Will Whedon about the season of Lent, and he said, we give up what we have because during Lent, and suddenly we realize we've got something left over to help those who are in great need. And this is the kind of situation. Christian education is not cheap. It requires not only the money to make the wheels turn, but also the support and the prayers for those who are poor. This is who we remember, not only during the season of Lent, but all throughout the Christian life as well. Paul Miller has been our guest to talk about Christian education in the inner city. When we come back, Adolf Harstad will join us to talk about divine warfare in the book of Joshua. Stay tuned.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, etc.
Joshua is one of the towering figures of the Old Testament, a successor to the prophet Moses, the first of the judges. He leads God's people into and through the promised land. But as great as Joshua is in the Old Testament, does he serve to prefigure someone even greater? Is there a connection between Joshua in the Old Testament and our Savior Jesus Christ in the New? Our Issues, etc. Book of the Month for February, the Concordia Commentary on the Book of Joshua, is a Christ-centered and cross-focused reading of this Old Testament book. For more information, go to our website, issuesetc.org. You'll find information there on the Concordia Commentary on Joshua, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February. Or call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours. Their number, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040.
Creatures, but back from the dead?
Answers with Ken Ham, whose ministry is building a large creation museum near Cincinnati, Ohio. Well, come on now, Ken, you're telling me creatures can come back from the dead?
Well, not exactly. The kind of creatures I'm talking about are the ones that never actually died. Now, let me explain. There are many creatures and plants that evolutionists thought had been extinct for millions of years, but have actually turned up alive. They're called living fossils. Now, one such example is the coelacanth fish. Evolutionists believe they became extinct 60 to 70 million years ago, but then fishermen in Madagascar have been catching them for years, and they've also been sold in Indonesian fish markets. The living coelacanth looks almost exactly like the fossil coelacanth. You see, the fossil record doesn't show any changes in their form, which you'd expect if evolution were true, just minor variations as creationists would expect. They didn't evolve during their supposed millions of years. Now, if molecules to man evolution were true, then surely the fossils would show major changes of form over the years. But the fact that very little change has taken place confirms a record of the history in Genesis.
In a fascinating free booklet, Ken Ham reveals that Christians can't believe in millions of years. It's one of the topics he tackles in his free booklet on why there's so much death and suffering in the world. You can read it at AnswersRadio.com. AnswersRadio.com.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. Psychologists tell us that children formulate their moral values by repetitive observations. In other words, if a child sees something often enough, he will start believing that's the way it should be. This is why it is important to know what your children are watching on TV. TV often teaches that happiness comes from material possessions, violence is glamorous, and sexual immorality is a valid lifestyle. When you are watching TV with your children, don't let these themes that are contrary to our Christian values slip by without comment. Remind your children that Jesus died to give us a better way of life, one that is characterized by peace, joy, and sexual purity. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute. Please visit our website at cmli.org.
AM 850 KFUO salutes our day sponsor on this Thursday, February 10th, 2005, Mary Schultz. Today's day sponsor has made a contribution to AM 850 KFUO in loving memory of the Reverend Donald A. Schultz on the fourth anniversary of his entrance into our heavenly kingdom. During his life of service to our Lord, he lived his confirmation verse, "I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of salvation to everyone who believes." Once again, we say thank you to Mary Schultz of Redbud, Illinois.
Welcome back. Last 25 minutes of Issues Etc., we're going to be talking about something that has presented a problem really for centuries for students of the Bible. Now, maybe this problem is simply due to our sensibilities, our modern sensibilities about things like warfare and the kind of campaigns that we see being waged by God's own people, Israel, in the book of Joshua. There's a book sitting on my shelf, and I found it of particular interest earlier in my pastoral experience, called The Problem of War in the Old Testament. Why did it catch my attention? Well, I'd read the Old Testament like the book of Joshua, and I'd say, man, this is... seems pretty harsh. God seems to be a commander of armies. In fact, he claims to be the one who's fighting real war for his own people in their conquest of the land. We're going to talk about divine warfare in the book of Joshua and the beginning of the conquest of the promised land with Dr. Adolf Harsted. He is professor of Old Testament theology at Bethany Lutheran Seminary in Mankato, Minnesota, and he's author of our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February, the Concordia Commentary on Joshua. Before we get to that, let me tell you about the book. We're talking about a real, live, full-blown commentary. Everything you want to know about the book of Joshua from a scholarly standpoint, but also easily accessible to the layperson as well. The Concordia Commentary on Joshua, 905 pages. It's right here, and I can barely lift it with one hand. It's $42.99 plus shipping and handling. If you're interested in more information, just go to our website, issuesetc.org. When you get there, right there on the homepage, if you scroll down a little bit, you will see an image of and information on the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February, the Concordia Commentary on Joshua by our guest in this last 25 minutes, Adolf Harstad. Or you can call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours. Their toll-free number is 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. You can also visit them. There are two locations where you could pick up the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February, the Concordia Commentary on Joshua. One is here on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton at 801 DeMunn. When you come onto the campus in any direction, just follow the signs to the CPH bookstore. And when you go in, ask for the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February. Or 3558 South Jefferson in the city. When you go down there, mention that you heard about it on Issues Etc. The Concordia Commentary on Joshua, the number again, 1-800-325-3040, or our website, issuesetc.org. How do you deal with this? You have, at the beginning of Joshua's chronicle, a preparation for war. It is always in view that the people and the people's armies are going to be making war. Some bloodshed will be required. Now, at that point, you might think, okay, we've read about wars in the Old Testament. But as you read on in the book of Joshua, it's not just some bloodshed, it's a lot of bloodshed. In some cases, the command is, well, I don't know how you put it, extermination. Leave your city or die. And everything is to be put to the sword in some cases in the book of Joshua. And the book of Joshua is largely a chronicle of war. Joshua himself, a general. If you had to put it in modern terms, what Joshua did, he wasn't a king, he wasn't a prince, he wasn't a prophet. And while he was the spiritual leader of God's people after Moses, he was, more than anything else, a commander of armies. One of the first encounters that we find in the book of Joshua is with this mysterious figure, this angel of the Lord that appears as the commander of the Lord's armies. Our guest, Dr. Harstad, has intimated in an earlier conversation that figure might, in fact, be the pre-incarnate Christ himself, the one whom Joshua prefigures. And there's kind of a two-tier thing going on here in the book of Joshua. There are the battles being waged by God's people with their weapons against flesh and blood. And then at the same time, God assures them it is he who is doing the fighting, and that his armies are the ones who are actually bringing about the victory for the Israelite armies. You can't always see that. In fact, you very seldom see it in the book of Joshua. So how do we deal with the problem of war? Many people will look back into the Old Testament and they will say, in a book like Joshua, they will say, okay, this was just a different time and a different set of rules prevailed. God was operating, and for the time being, he was operating kind of as the ancient Middle East despot and his armies. Total war was the solution when it was your property and you were going to take it back. God says, it's my property. I promised it to Abraham. Is that as simple as a solution as you can get? Is that the best solution? That God is simply accommodating himself to the culture of the ancient Near East? That he's acting as an ancient Near East despot and his armies behave accordingly? Something more going on in the book of Joshua with regard to war. Should we be offended by what we read there? Adolf Harstad is professor of Old Testament theology at Bethany Lutheran Seminary in Mankato, Minnesota, and author of the Concordia Commentary on Joshua, our book of the month for February. Dr. Harstad, welcome back.
Thank you. Always a pleasure to be with you, Todd.
The biggest problem for me when I was reading through Joshua as I began more intense studies, was coming face-to-face with and having the veil of kind of the Sunday school veneer removed and realizing that these were real wars and this was real blood that was being shed in the conquest of the land. Should this be a problem for us?
Well, certainly we should be sensitive to such issues. The taking of human life should never be something that's done lightly, obviously. Even even when capital punishment is rightly carried out. There is the sanctity of human life, and it is a somber time. And here we have, in the book of Joshua, the conquering of whole peoples, the Canaanites, if we want to use that collective term. But you know, we human beings and God's agents at that time, the Jews, are not the issue there. This was God's judgment, and he has the perfect right when people despise his grace at his wise time to end that time of grace. And for his purposes in history, and finally for the salvation of the world, this is what he decided to do in connection with the Canaanites in that land.
Tell us, just so you could set our mind in the proper context, because we were talking about a chronicle of war, and it begins, this second part of Joshua begins with Joshua meeting a greater commander than even he himself, the commander of the Lord's armies, there in that mysterious meeting. But tell us about what ancient warfare would have entailed. We think about tanks and helicopters. What was warfare like in those days?
Well, there are some instruments of war that are mentioned in the Bible, of course. In the book of Joshua itself, chariots are mentioned, and the burning of these chariots, so that even though these chariots were made of iron in their axles, they're evidently mostly of wood. Spears are mentioned, swords are mentioned, so there would be much hand-to-hand combat, obviously. We can get a picture of ancient warfare, literal pictures from reliefs and Egyptian art and so forth, so we can even see some of these instruments of warfare.
It was bloody business, wasn't it?
Indeed. Now, the account of Joshua does not dwell on that, though. I mean, you don't find pictures of gore and so forth in the scenes of Joshua. Luther comments on that also, that we shouldn't dwell on that in connection with the book of Joshua, because that's not the stress of the book itself. Yes, this is God's judgment, and yes, life was taken. But we just have to leave this into God's hands and realize that he's the Lord of heaven and earth, and he has the perfect right for both his judgment purposes and his saving purposes to take the life of his enemies.
Tell us about what you call Joshua's encounter with the divine commander that takes place there in the fifth chapter.
That's a fascinating encounter. And it is parallel to the account of Moses at the burning bush. The way that the author describes this, it's like zooming in closer and closer in each successive verse. It appears, by the way, in Joshua 5, verses 13 to 15. And Joshua is near Jericho. And the first expression we have is that he simply sees a man. He looks up and, wow, surprise, there's a man. He's taken by total surprise. So, man, he's called. And then the man calls himself the commander of the army of the Lord. That focuses our attention a little bit more. Now, Joshua is the earthly commander of the army of the Lord, so this is not some mere man. We're alerted to that already in that second account. And then we have Joshua down on the ground worshiping this man, if we can call him that. And finally, we have the person speaking, and he tells Joshua, take off the sandals from your feet, because the place where you are standing is holy ground. And there our mind says, that's exactly what the Lord said to Moses at the burning bush. So without spelling it out, I think it is clear in the author's intention to tell us that this is the Lord himself, probably Jesus pre-incarnate, speaking to Joshua just before Joshua's battles to assure Joshua that the heavenly forces are with him.
He says, I am the commander of the Lord's armies. This begins a theme in the whole conquest saga, almost a battle we can see and a battle we can't see. Tell us about it.
Yeah, that's right. There are the earthly battles, but at the same time, there are the spiritual battles going on. Joshua is fighting both of them in a sense. He's visible on earth with what he does in regard to Jericho and the other cities that are conquered in those chapters from chapters 6 through 12 of Joshua. But at the same time, this is the Lord's spiritual battle. He's preparing this physical land eventually for his son, who will himself single-handedly defeat the forces of hell, Satan himself.
The famous story from Sunday school is, of course, the fall of Jericho and the Jericho's walls coming down. It's interesting that the first time they engage a city in battle, they don't do battle at all, really. They do something quite different.
Yeah. Later on in the book of Joshua, we're going to get this phrase that this is not by your sword and not by your bow. And the idea is that this is the Lord himself who is really doing the fighting. So that certainly comes out in the account of Jericho. They go through this ritual of passing around the city each day for 6 days and then seven times on the seventh day. And then as the Lord said would happen, the walls come tumbling down. The expression there, by the way, is fascinating also. It says literally that the wall fell under itself, which means that it didn't teeter and totter and then flop over so that whole sections of it remained intact, but instead it came straight down. I suppose you and I have pictures of the towers in 9/11 where that was indeed the same case, where they did not totter and fall, but they simply went straight down. The idea in this expression in Joshua is that the city is completely destroyed because it is at God's hand. This was not some natural phenomenon that caused this, not some earthquake in the area, but this was by the hand of God, the complete destruction of the city for God's purposes.
Why is Jericho set apart as somewhat unique in that after the destruction of Jericho and the taking of the city, Joshua basically lays a curse upon anyone who would try to rebuild the place?
Yeah, it seems to be something like the first fruits, you know, which belong to the Lord. Nothing is to be taken for personal use from that city. And, of course, we learned that one man did disobey that command, and that's coming up in the next chapter. But that seems to be it, that the first fruits belong totally to the Lord, and so everything is given over to him because he is the victor.
The second is a defeat, and the second is a defeat at the hand of a city that shouldn't have been able to put up any resistance to Israel's armies, the city of Ai. It's connected with what you just mentioned, disobedience on the part of one man in the Jericho campaign.
Yeah, we might be impressed that all of Israel obeyed except one man, but that's not the Lord's attitude towards this. The one man disobeys and takes of those forbidden things from the city of Jericho. And for the disobedience of one man, the whole nation feels the effect. Collective retribution. And it's a reminder, by one man, sin entered into the world also. You and I and everyone else was affected by the sin of one man, Adam. Now, the gospel parallel to this is, of course, that by the one man, Jesus Christ, all of this is undone. And through his obedience and his death, we are rescued.
We're talking with Dr. Adolf Harstad, author of our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for February, the Concordia Commentary on Joshua, and professor of Old Testament Theology at Bethany Lutheran Seminary in Mankato, Minnesota, about divine warfare in the book of Joshua. This is part two of an ongoing series we're doing on the book of Joshua this month on Issues, Etc. Our call-in numbers, if you have a question or a comment, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Mark calls from his car. Mark, welcome.
Pastor Todd, there's a line in Genesis where God says, I believe it's to Abraham, that the Israelites are going to go down to Egypt for 400 years because the sin of the Amorites is not yet full. In other words, this is a matter of justice, and we think so very highly of ourselves, and we don't deserve it, and we don't think highly enough of God. And I guess that's my comment. that when we're talking about this warfare, we're talking about God's justice, and we're talking about what we deserve, and God waits until we really do deserve it, rather than, you know, acting capriciously or unfairly or anything else like that. Very good discussion. I'm very much enjoying it. I'll hang up now and listen to your comments.
Great, Mark. Thank you very much. Dr. Harstad.
Yeah, excellent point from Mark. He sounds like a very articulate man. Yeah, he points out that passage in Genesis, about 400 years, and it reminds us of the grace of God for all of those years, Canaanites, the Amorites, all those people of the land, called collectively there, by the way, in that passage as Amorites. They had all of this time to learn about the living God, and yet they choose not to. They continue with their child sacrifices. They continue with their ritual prostitution. They continue worshiping all their other gods. And they had access to knowledge of the true God. We know that from Rahab in the city of Jericho, that the Canaanites knew about God and yet willfully rejected his deliverance. You know, this is also a wonderful picture, talking about Rahab again, as we did a couple of days ago, that she is a Canaanite, and God is intent on salvation, and she is spared as he turns her heart to him. So God is not bent on destruction. God is not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. But there is a time when God's justice must be executed. And at his good time, after many long years of grace and patience, that time does come.
The perpetrator of the sin at Jericho is eventually discovered. God, in fact, instructs Joshua on how to find out who it was. And Achan is punished, along with his whole family. And the punishment does seem, at least to our modern sensibilities, to some kind of over the top. Everybody's stoned.
Well, there is a question there, Todd. If you carefully examine the language of what happens there at the execution, it cannot be shown conclusively that anybody other than Achan himself was stoned. His family was brought there. Maybe they observed. But when it comes to the stoning of things later on, it cannot be shown conclusively that this involved his family. Now, if it did, that of course means that his family was complicit in the crime, that they knew about it and that they were a part of it. We don't know for sure whether his family was executed. There's something else here. He gives a wonderful confession. And even though his body is executed, he may well be in heaven because of his confession. That happens often, that the person ushered from death row to the electric chair is also ushered into heaven at the same time, regardless of the horrible nature of sin. And, of course, we see that with the thief on the cross. Today you'll be with me in paradise. So that may well have been the case with Achan also.
In the midst of the ongoing campaign, Ai is eventually then retaken. There is what you call an interlude for worship in word and sacrament, beginning in Joshua 8. What's going on here?
Yes. There we have that wonderful section where the altar is built and sacrifices are made and the blessings and curses are spoken from Mount Gerizim and Ebal. Time is taken for great spiritual things. It's a wonderful example of seek first the kingdom of God and all these things will be added to you. The nation takes time out in the middle of, you know, they could have kept on warring, but the covenant is the most important thing. Their relationship to God is the most important thing, and they carry out these spiritual ceremonies.
We can only glance over the top here. I would be so interested to talk about the Gibeonites in the book of Joshua because it's a tremendous story to tell.
Yeah.
But there is the one story that stands out. The sun stands still in the sky during a campaign in Joshua chapter 10. Tell us that story very briefly.
Okay. It comes in defense of the Gibeonites. Remember, these tricky people had tricked Israel into a treaty. but they are welcomed into Israel, and then they are threatened by surrounding kings. Well, Joshua rushes with his army to defend the Gibeonites, and during the battle, it seems like there isn't going to be enough time to enough daylight to continue and complete the battle. So Joshua prays, and then we have this spectacular account of the sun standing still in the middle of the sky and granting time for Israel to defeat the enemies. It takes place at the Valley of Adullam, the moon is still in the sky, and the sun is in the sky. One of those great scenes. By the way, I'm thinking of a trip that we took to Israel a couple of years ago now. Kind of hard to get to Israel these days. But exactly that scene prevailed as we were driving from Jerusalem toward Ben-Gurion Airport. The moon was in the sky, and this is right in the same area, right near the Valley of Adullam. The moon is in the sky, and the sun was coming up, and I grabbed my Bible, and I read that chapter from Joshua.
With only about less than 1 minute here before we have to wrap up this part of our conversation, Dr. Harstad, this story and all the others that we find in this section of Joshua, of God going out of his way, even harnessing the planetary bodies in order to bring victory to his people, what's the message for us today?
Well, the message in connection with that text is don't be afraid to pray. We don't live in a universe that came about by accident. God created it. Yes, he set the laws of nature in motion, but he can still overrule them. And look at this fantastic event. When a man prayed, God allowed this mighty thing to happen. So it's obviously a chapter inviting our bold prayers. You're coming to a king, large petitions with you bring.
Next time with Dr. Harstad, we're going to talk about how the land is apportioned out to the people of Israel after this conquest in the book of Joshua. Dr. Harstad, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thanks again to you.
Dr. Adolf Harstad is professor of Old Testament theology at Bethany Lutheran Seminary in Mankato, Minnesota. He has authored our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for February, the Concordia Commentary on Joshua. Again, if you are interested in getting this commentary, in-depth, Christ-centered, cross-focused reading of this Old Testament book that sometimes troubles and mystifies many students of the Old Testament, 1-800-325-3040 is the toll-free number of Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, or issuesetc.org is our website. If you go to that website and just stay right there on the homepage, scroll down a little bit, you'll find an image of and information on the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for February, the Concordia Commentary on Joshua. It's $42.99 plus shipping and handling, 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org. There are two locations, again, I remind you, where you can visit. That is one at 3558 South Jefferson in the city. Ask for the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for February. The other one is here on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton, 801 DeMunn. Follow the signs to the CPH bookstore. Again, 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org. Tomorrow on the program, we'll respond to skeptics of the New Testament with Greg Kokol. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues, Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.